Good morning, brothers and sisters. You know, I thought I stopped being nervous some years ago, but for some reason this morning my hands are just shaking. So it might take a moment for the for that to settle. We ended up last class yesterday finishing up on Ezekiel 34. 2 points before we move on. On the chart which I prepared of Ezekiel's prophecies of the restoration, one of the things that I think it bears for us to pay note to is that when it comes to the prophecies of the restoration, each of them from 34 on is going to end. Some places it'll be more in the middle, some at the beginning of the prophecy, but it's going to take us to the kingdom of God. There will be an allusion. And in chapter 34, you know, really by verse 12, we had the Good Shepherd appearing. Now, why am I making a big point about that? Why is that important? I think it's important because we have discussions in our community at times about, well, Ezekiel is written chronologically, so if Christ returns in a certain chapter, everything after it must happen after the return of the Lord. Well, to those that may feel that way, particularly about Ezekiel 37, to those who feel that, well, since Ezekiel 37 contains a remark about the return of Christ, therefore everything after must be after His return, well, the Lord returns in chapter 34. Is everything after that after His return? The Lord returns in chapter 36 clearly too. Is everything after or after? Ultimately, what we have here in Ezekiel's prophecies of the resurrection... See, I'm going to have to settle myself down. I'm not used to shaking like this. Ezekiel's prophecies of the restoration they're very telescopic, like the apocalypse. And that's the point that I'm trying to make as I continue to chart out for you this chart. The second thing that I'll make mention of before we go on is Ezekiel gave his prophecy of the Good Shepherd while a captive in Babylon. And I would suggest to you that that is typical, that the Good Shepherd does not appear to gather the sheep until the latter day conglomerates that make up this great latter day Babylon are ruling over them. With that said, we get into chapter 35, which I'm going to go through rather quickly. I would highly recommend to each of you Brother Lou Locklear's classes on Edom. I know that some were given here. I think they're on the Arkansas Bible School's website. The classes he gave at home for us in Orlando are on my website, phanerosis.org, and he does a good job, because I'm going to fly through this. In my Bible, I have at the top of chapter 35 the note, Gentile political power defeated. And I think ultimately that's the depiction we see here. I think it's noteworthy to pay attention to the fact that in Ezekiel's prophecies of the restoration, why do we have Edom thrust here into the middle? You know, why does the Lord go from chapter 34 and not just go into the discussions of chapter 36. Why did Yahweh deem it so? Why is there this chapter which superficially seems to break up the thought? And I think it's because we need to see a parallel in some respects to chapter 35 and chapter 38 is the intention. There is a great struggle in mankind. Genesis chapter 25, Verse 22 and 23, the children struggled together within her, and she said, if it be so, why am I thus? And she went to inquire of Yahweh, and Yahweh said unto her, two nations are in thy womb, and two manner of people shall be separated from thy bowels. Edom is really a typical nation. And I think that when you look at the book of Hebrews, you'll see some clues here that are, I think, are very important. You know, we have the contrast between Zion, if you will, and Edom. Two great mounts, Mount Zion and Mount Edom. And each of them are representative of a great political power. It's interesting that in Hebrews 12:22, we see that those who are of the seed of the woman, if you will, are likened unto Mount Zion, while in Hebrews 12:16, those who are profane are likened unto Esau or Edom. So Edom, I would suggest to you, is typical of sin politically manifested in the last days in opposition to Mount Zion. As a people, Edom vanished 2,000 years ago, over 2,000 years ago. The Maccabeans forced what was left of the Edomites to assimilate. So as a people, Edom does not exist. So they are clearly a symbolic people. They were forced to assimilate by the Maccabeans. And we suggest to you that this is typical of the fact that the Gentiles are going to be forced, those that are left, just like it was those who were left of Edom that the Maccabeans forced to assimilate. That's why you had Herod the Idumean, because they were forced to assimilate. The Gentiles will be forced to assimilate as well. Isaiah 60:12 says, for the nation and kingdom that will not serve thee shall perish. Yea, those nations shall be utterly wasted. There will be a forced assimilation. Mount Seir is typical of Babylon the Great. Two of these references I'm going to read and compare. Malachi 1:3 first. We read Malachi 1:3, I hated Esau and laid his mountains and his heritage waste for the dragons of the wilderness. All right? So Esau's mountains are going to be laid waste, desolate. In the Apocalypse chapter 18, in verse 2, we read, Babylon the Great is fallen. It's become the habitation of devils and the hold of every foul spirit and a cage of every unclean and hateful bird. It's no coincidence then, brethren and sisters, that Esau, Edom, and Babylon have the same fate described scripturally that happens unto them both. I think the theme of the chapter, if you will, then is somewhat expressed in Luke 21:24 and Romans 11:25. Luke 21:24 should be so familiar to us that it's a memory verse. Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. What is the situation of Israel throughout the times of the Gentiles according to Romans 11:25? They are in blindness. So as long as the Jews, I'm not sure what I just, I'm, you know, I had this little flash in my brain that I just misspoke on something because I, you know, since I don't speak off notes, I hope I phrased that right. I think that's my nerves getting to me this morning. Romans 11:25, I thought I phrased it wrong, has Israel being in blindness until the times of the Gentiles are completed. And I think that's an important parallel because in our community we have heard many times that the times of the Gentiles were fulfilled in 1917. Brethren, if that was true, Israel would no longer be in blindness. Paul and Luke must agree. Israel's blindness will disappear at the close of the Gentile times. And I think that's somewhat the theme of this chapter, is the trotting down, if you will, that takes place over Israel by those who are typified of Edom. And at the close of the chapter, Edom is defeated. Those times come to a close, and Israel is free. The chapter concludes with a very important phrase, "They shall know that I am Yahweh." And I take this phrase for myself to be very important. And I think that what we're going to see is the Edomites of our day, they're going to know who Yahweh is when these punishments are meted out. Verses 1 through 5 of the chapter describe a territory in Edom that are going to be left most desolate, cities waste. But this is not literally true, prophetically, of these territories in the kingdom age. So while Edom's territories are going to be, symbolical Edom, waste, we might say turned into a lake of fire, the literal territory that we know is not going to be that way. What does Isaiah prophesy about this territory? "Let the wilderness and the cities thereof lift up their voice, the villages that Kedar doth inhabit. Let the inhabitants of the rocks sing. Let them shout from the top of the mountains." Chapter 43:20, "The beasts of the field shall honor me, the dragons and the owls, because I gave waters in the wilderness and the rivers in the desert to give drink to my people, my chosen." You know, what is now considered the territory of ancient Edom is going to be part of the kingdom, and it's going to blossom and bud and be fruitful, while symbolic Edom will be laid waste and fulfill what we have here in this 35th chapter. Revelation 16:19, I'm not going to read, but it speaks of the great city Babylon being divided into three parts and then becoming waste, becoming desolate. And I think that's a parallel to what we see here. There's a phrase here that I think is important in Ezekiel 35 that we need to make sure that we understand. Verse 5 concludes with the phrase, "In the time of their calamity, in the time that their iniquity had an end." The NASB renders this as "at the time of the punishment of the end." Now, I think that's an interesting rendering. Rotherham has it as "in the time of the final punishment for iniquity." That's a really good rendering. So Ezekiel 35 is taking us to the time of the final punishment for iniquity. And I think now we know why it's included in the restoration prophecies. Because Israel's restoration and elevation will also bring the final punishment for iniquity on those typified by Edom. I think we'll find parallels to Ezekiel 38 there. We'll find parallels to Revelation 18. We'll find parallels to Jeremiah chapter 30 as well. Harold said he's talking about Jeremiah 30 tonight. I'm not going to go to that verse in case he's going to touch upon it. Verses 6 through 8 speak of a power that does not hate blood. In Revelation chapter 18, in verse 6, we have this about Babylon or Edom in latter-day manifestation. "Reward her even as she rewarded you. Double unto her, double according to her works. In the cup which she hath filled to her, double." And then verse 24. "And in her was found the blood of the prophets and of the saints." Because Edom loved blood and blood will pursue her. Think about what is said in Ezekiel 39 in verse 17. "In the blood of Gog that will be poured out." It's also said that there would be no more travelers from this moment on within Edom. The idiom that's used here in the verse is something that refers to an admirer. And that's not going to be something that is going to happen within the kingdom age, because there will be a great many travelers through what was the territory of Edom. But there will be no more travelers through the lake of fire or the territory of Babylon the Great. People won't be making trips anymore to Rome to view the sights, if you will, to put it in a vernacular that hits the point that I'm getting at. There will be no more them that passeth in and out of the latter-day Edom. They will be passing in and out of Jerusalem and Zion and coming to offer worship and praise to Yahweh. These series of verses also talk that his mountains will be filled with his slain. Verse 8, his mountains will be filled with all those that are slain. Ezekiel 39, 4 and 5, we see a parallel to there to Gog's fate as well, do we not? And in Isaiah 34, we will also see a parallel. I had originally intended on reading that verse, but I'm gonna try to cut like 2 minutes off of this, so we'll move on. As we continue through chapter 35, it is mentioned in verse 9 that thy cities shall not return. Thy city shall not return. And once again, this is not something that is true of what was the ancient territory of Edom, because it's going to be incorporated into the kingdom. But the great cities of Babylon the Great will not return. Just as the Maccabees destroyed the last of Edom, the last of the latter-day Edom will be destroyed. They will either assimilate or be slain with the sword. And that's the purpose of the everlasting gospel proclamation in Revelation chapter 14 that's given. You know, there is the opportunity for some to forsake the way of the latter-day Edom. The everlasting gospel proclamation will be a life or death proclamation. Make no mistake, if the Gentiles do not submit to the call to fear God and keep His commandments, they will be destroyed. They will be slain. We also have within this chapter the mention that there was a seeking of Edom to possess these two nations. These two countries would be mine. And typical Edom has tried to control the diaspora Jew. They've tried to control the Jew in the land throughout their history. The Catholic Church and those political powers, which we find in an answer to this Esau-Edom power, they have tried to rule over these peoples. Verses 10 through 15, as we begin to sum up the chapter, we find out that this is the place that they've tried to control, is the place that Yahweh will be. And I think this kind of points us a little bit to Ezekiel 35 is truly trying to hone into the final punishment for iniquity. You know, they're not going to succeed because, you know, Yahweh will be there. The multitudinous Christ will defeat them. We're told in these verses that I will make myself known among them when I have judged thee. Literal Edom. Was Yahweh made known when they suffered their judgments? I don't think we see anything that answers to that, do we? But we know there is this day coming where in the defeat of the latter-day Edom that Yahweh will be made known. Think about Ezekiel 39, 22 through 23, what's said there. Look at that later. Verse 12, and thou shalt know that I am Yahweh, and that I have heard all thy blasphemies, which thou hast spoken against the mountains of Israel, saying, they are laid desolate, they are given us to consume. You know, this latter-day power, Edom, let's just put it this way, Edom, Babylon the Great, Gog, they think it's in their hand to consume the ancient places and the holy high hill. But in doing so, they have blasphemed. And their blasphemies will be punished. Once again, I think it's critical to understand the phrase, the mountains of Israel here. And I'm going to be, let me be just a little bit more blunt than I was yesterday when I spoke about the mountains of Israel. You know, there has been a question over the last 30 years that I've been in the truth, and probably even longer than that, where does Gog get to? Well, the answer in some people's minds, oh, he only gets to the mountains of Israel, and that's all. But once again, it's critical to note how this phrase, the mountains of Israel, is used in these restoration prophecies. It's used in a much wider scope than just any northern mountains. In fact, it's used here is in the scope of Mount Zion. Is not Mount Zion the chief of the mountains of Israel? Has not Babylon the Great blasphemed against the holy mount of Yahweh? So when we look at this phrase, the mountains of Israel, and particularly young Bible students, I don't want you to be steered in one direction on this. I think as we look at them in Ezekiel's prophecies of the restoration, you're going to see them used as a typical description of where Israel will be blessed. Sometimes I believe the phrase the mountains of Israel will be used to describe the nation as a whole, the people themselves, not the literal territory, such as when in both Ezekiel 36 and 37, the mountains of Israel are told to hear the word of Yahweh. So I think it's really critical that we understand this phrase, the mountains of Israel. If all we're ever going to study is Ezekiel 38, maybe it doesn't become as clear to us if we have doubts of what that means. But if you look at Ezekiel 33, 34, 35, 36, 37, and 38, it's clear that the mountains of Israel cannot be a limited territory. We have to make ourselves willingly, we have to willingly limit our understanding to arrive at that conclusion once we consider these prophecies as a whole. And we can't do that. Another interesting phrase where we conclude here within Ezekiel 35 is notice that in verse 14, the whole earth rejoices when Edom is made desolate. Certainly the whole earth did not rejoice when the Maccabeans assimilated the rest of the Edomites. Nothing happened there when they disappeared as a people. But this will be a particular period in which the entire earth rejoices. Is that not a phrase that helps us understand that this brings us to the millennium? The whole earth rejoices. It's those that are going to be left are going to rejoice. They're going to be glad they no longer have to live under the papal domination of superstition. The whole earth will rejoice. Verse 15, thou shalt be desolate. We think about Daniel chapter 7 in verse 11 and what is said there. I beheld then because of the voice of the great words which the horn spake, I beheld even till the beast was slain and his body destroyed, made desolate, if you will, and given to the burning flame. And then just think about the very last phrase of this 35th chapter. They shall know that I am Yahweh. I think the fullness of this phrase requires that the power spoken of understands and realizes in their dying breath that they blasphemed against the God of heaven. I don't think this phrase simply means that, well, those who are left after Edom is destroyed are going to know who Yahweh is. O Mount Seir and all Edom, even all of it, they shall know that I am Yahweh. They will know. So in reality, I want to suggest to you very strongly, is my mouse showing up there? Yeah. That chapter 35 also brings us to this telescopic view of the apocalypse, if you will. That same type of an idea. We have this restoration prophecy also concluding with the kingdom age. All right, let's move on to chapter 36 now that I spent what I call 15 minutes on chapter 35. Obviously, I can't tell time. A very important chapter, one that I think we probably read things on and hear things on a little bit more frequently than some of the other chapters. But I believe that it is a chapter that it is all too often misunderstood. As we start off in Ezekiel 36, the first verse says, "Son of man, prophesy unto the mountains of Israel and say, ye mountains of Israel, hear the word of Yahweh." We know that literal mountains are inanimate objects and they do not hear. But much in the same way that the scattered sheep of Ezekiel 34 were in need of the great shepherd to hear the word, the Son of Man in Ezekiel 36 here is told to cause the mountains of Israel to hear the word of Yahweh. In Ezekiel 36 and 37, both, I would suggest to you that when we read the phrase Son of Man in reference to Ezekiel, it helps us to understand that he is a man who is typical of the Son of Man. We know from the Scriptures that hearing implies the acknowledgement of truth, does it not? Romans 10:17. How does faith come? But by the hearing of the Word. And since we're here where it's real easy to turn over, I just want to you to start mulling this over in verse 4 of Ezekiel 37. Again, he said unto me, prophesy unto these bones and say unto them, O ye dry bones, hear the word of Yahweh. Ezekiel 36, a chapter that speaks about the cleansing of Israel. In Ezekiel 37, which speaks about the gathering of the bones, both have their foundation in hearing the word of Yahweh. And without the word of Yahweh clearly manifested, neither can the cleansing of Israel nor the reassembling of the bones occur. It is the word of Yahweh that is the catalyst to both events. Which is why I read for you the Christadelphian unamended statement of faith on Saturday night, which clearly uses both of these chapters in that regard. The word Shema here means to hear with an intelligence. It implies an understanding, a comprehension, not just to listen. Many of you may be listening right now, but not hearing me. Hopefully everyone is hearing. In verse 2 of Ezekiel 36, the enemy had said, the ancient high places are ours. So the 36th chapter then begins at a time where prophetically the ancient high places are in possession of the enemy. This is why we've got to see things telescopically here. Chapter 34 ends with the kingdom age. Chapter 35 brings us to the destruction of Edom, Gog, Babylon, the kingdom age. And then chapter 36 starts off with, let's go back in time again. The ancient high places are ours. Rotherham renders it, the ancient high places have become ours. So at the beginning of this 36th chapter, when it's important for the word to be heard, the prophecy refers in the second verse to a time when the Gentiles rule in Jerusalem. might then the incipient fulfillment of the hearing of the word be part of the work of Elijah? Think about Malachi chapter 4, right? Daniel chapter 11, verse 45. Speaking of the king of the north, and he shall plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas in the glorious holy mountain, yet he shall come to his end and none shall help him. Daniel 11, 45, Ezekiel 36, 2, I suggest to you are parallel verses. Now, Yahweh willing, sometime between late class tomorrow and early on Thursday morning, we're going to speak a little bit about Daniel 11 in reference to Ezekiel 37. And just to kind of prepare your minds, I want you to start thinking this over, because we debate Daniel 11 and what it means in our community. But the problem is you have to willingly ignore the facts of history to suppose that Daniel 11 has been fulfilled. And I'm going to talk about why that is the case. You have to willingly suspend historically known facts to believe that Daniel 11 was fulfilled in 1917. And I think sometimes, brethren, we forget about what has happened in history. And there are some very clear historical facts that I think we can number out that prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that Daniel 11 could never have been fulfilled in 1917. And that's why we're making the point here in Ezekiel 36, 2, to think about them somewhat together. The 36th chapter continues in the third verse and speaks to Israel, saying that they have been made desolate. They have been swallowed up on every side. They have become the possession of the residue of the heathen. They have become a prey, verse 4 says. Now, as Ezekiel is writing this 36th chapter, do you think as he records the 38th chapter in his mind, he thinks it's quite interesting that both chapter 36 and 38 speak of a prey that the nation will become? So I think we need to make a connection here between Ezekiel 38:13 and a connection as well to this 36th chapter. We need to remember that Daniel also prophesied in the 9th chapter of a great desolation, a desolator that would come amongst the people. Daniel 9, 26, 27, after speaking of the 70 weeks prophecy ending, we go on to read that the covenant would be confirmed with many, that sacrifice and oblation would cease, and that then there would be an overspreading of abominations, and he shall make it desolate, even until the consummation shall be poured upon the desolator. Now, I've paraphrased that to Brother Thomas's translation as I read those verses. And I only say I paraphrase Brother Thomas's translation because I'm sure I didn't say that word for word. The 36th chapter continues in verse 5. Thus saith Adonai Yahweh, surely in the fire of my jealousy have I spoken against the residue of the heathen and against all Idumea, which have appointed my land into their possession with the joy of all their heart, with despiteful minds to cast it out for a prey. Isn't it interesting? And I've got a line in my Bible that I drew straight from chapter 35, 16, all the way over to 36, 5, and I connected those two dots. Isn't it interesting that in this 36th chapter, we refer again to this time of great desolation and the rescuing of Israel, because that's the ultimate of chapter 36. We're going to get to the cleansing of the people, but what are they cleansed from? They're cleansed from this Idumean power. I think it helps us to be strengthened that the concept here is that Idumea, Edom, is typical and typical of Babylon the Great and its cohorts in the last day. So this verse connects us with the judgments of Christ and the saints. They will be this fire that devours for the jealousy of Yahweh. Isaiah 42, verse 13. Yahweh shall go forth as a mighty man. He shall stir up jealousy like a man of war. He shall cry, yea, roar. He shall prevail against his enemies. Chapter 66, verses 15 and 16. For behold, Yahweh will come with fire, with his chariots like a whirlwind, to render his anger with fury and his rebuke with flames of fire. For by fire and by his sword will Yahweh plead with all flesh, and the slain of Yahweh shall be many. Zechariah 8:2. Thus saith Yahweh Sabaoth, I was jealous for Zion with great jealousy, and I was jealous for her with great fury. Zephaniah 3:8. Therefore wait upon me, saith Yahweh, until the day that I rise up to the prey. For my determination is to gather the nations, that I may assemble the kingdoms, to pour upon them mine indignation, even all my fierce anger. For all the earth shall be devoured with the fire of my jealousy. So in this fifth verse, we have an allusion to the deliverance that will come to the lost sheep through the great shepherd and those who work with him in this 36th chapter. What is said in chapter 34 in many ways is now being repeated here in chapter 36 with a different perspective, a different point of view, with a little bit more information. I already spoke about Idumea. See, I can't even stick to my notes when I don't have them. Verse 6. Prophesy therefore concerning the land of Israel, and say unto the mountains, and to the hills, to the rivers, and to the valleys, thus saith Adonai Yahweh, behold, I have spoken in my jealousy and in my fury, because ye have borne the shame of the heathen. This is really important to understand, that Israel bears the shame of the heathen until when? Until Yahweh comes in the fire of his jealousy. It's important because we need to make sure that we don't put ourselves into position that we think that Israel is going to bear their shame into the kingdom age. Because, brethren, there and young people, you may read some articles on this, to where there are some people that are going to suggest that, well, Ezekiel 39 and 38 happen after Christ is in the land, and they're going to bear their shame then in the kingdom based on one verse in Ezekiel 39. But there's no other scripture that backs up that Septuagint translation. Actually, Ezekiel 39 doesn't say they bear their shame. It's just one Septuagint translation that does. But that's not what the scriptures teach. The scriptures teach that Israel will bear their shame, and then the great shepherd will take it away. Let's kind of prove that. Or let's not kind of prove it. Let's prove it. Isaiah 54 in verse 4. Fear not, for thou shalt not be ashamed, neither be thou confounded, for thou shalt not be put to shame. For thou shalt forget the shame of thy youth, and shall not remember the reproach of thy widowhood any more. Joel 2:27. And ye shall know that I am in the midst of Israel, and that I am Yahweh your God, and none else, and my people shall never be ashamed. My people will never be ashamed. Ezekiel 34 and 29 as well makes reference to this. When we go back and take a look at that chapter, in the end of that verse, the shame of the heathen anymore will no longer be upon them. And just to make sure that, young people, if you weren't following me on my point, turn over to chapter 39 of Ezekiel, verse 26, speaking of after Gog's defeat. After that, They have borne their shame and all their trespasses whereby they have trespassed against me when they dwelt safely in their land and none made them afraid. Well, in my mind and in most all of us in this room, you know, we understand that this verse is speaking of the fact that after Gog is defeated, the captivity of Israel will cease and they will no longer be in shame. For those brethren who have sought to maintain that no, Gog never defeats them, they have used one translation from the Septuagint which renders this verse as, and they will then bear shame after their captivity ends. Well, that translation is just not in accord with any other verse in the Bible. And I just read to you very clearly from Isaiah, from Joel, and elsewhere in Ezekiel that the kingdom age is the end of shame for natural Israel. There won't be any more shame to bear amongst the heathen in the kingdom age. And if you read those brethren who teach that after Gog's defeat, now it will be time for Israel to bear their shame, they're not paying attention to the rest of the scriptures. And we've got to make sure that we are looking at the scriptures from the beginning to the end on these subjects. And this 36th chapter of Ezekiel points very clearly that what is a portion of Yahweh's jealousy? It's because He does not want the children of Abraham to forever bear the shame imposed upon them by the heathen. He will deliver them from that shame. Are you ready to ring the bell, Jack, or we got a few minutes? You're nodding your head, yes, it's time. If you don't ring it, I'm going to keep going. So you just tell me which. Thank you.